Of the conference for inviting me and for the hospitality of the Perimeter Institute. So the main idea of this talk is to try to show you that weak values are ever more present than we may think at first hand, okay? And the hint as to why we can think of this is that we have to pay special attention, in the measuring process, but also we can think of interactions generally as types of measurements as well. And so it's pay attention to the variable that serves as a conjugate variable to what we call the pointer. Okay, and so what I want to do is, first of all, in a very simplified setting, try to set up a picture, okay, of the measuring process where the emphasis is on the weak values, okay? And this is not necessarily constrained to what we call weak measurements. This is actually something that is quite more general. Okay, so this is, I'm sure, familiar to all of us. This is the von Neumann measurement scheme. We usually discuss in connection with weak measurements. So it's not only the standard measurement scheme with a pre-selection, but we also have a post-selection, okay? And we have a system, okay? So pre-selected in state psi I, post-selected in state psi F, interacting with some measuring device that is defined in some initial state phi, that this should be a not, okay? In the rest of the talk, it should be a phi not, okay? And so we're going to be interested in what the effect is on the measuring device. The variables that are of interest here will be, first of all, this variable x, which is the one that couples to the Hamiltonian, and that's the one variable that I would like you to pay particular attention to, and the measured observable a, okay? And so this variable x, I will refer to it as the reaction variable because it's the variable that somehow reacts back on the system, okay? And this is the conjugate to the pointer variable, which is usually the one that, we pay more attention to, okay? So we all know this thing. I just want to formulate it in a particular language. So conditional on the pre-selection and the post-selection of the system, okay, we have a change in the state that describes the measuring device, okay? And this change can be affected by essentially a Krauss operator, okay, acting on this initial state of the device. But this Krauss operator, if we look at it in the position representation, it's basically just the amplitude, the transition amplitude from psi I to psi F, but mediated by the evolution operator that's implemented by the measurement, okay? There is also a normalization factor, this factor over here, okay? And this we can think of it as just the expectation value of K modulus squared with the initial state of the device, okay? So what I want you to do now is to try to look at this amplitude, this Kx, okay, from a different perspective. Let's look at it in terms of its polar decomposition, okay? So we have its modulus and we have the phase. And what I would like to show is that these two parts contain two pieces of information that are crucial, that I believe are crucial in understanding what's going on with pre and post-selected measurements. What's the idea? Well, we always hear this discussion about, with post-selection, we have Bayes' theorem, and so there's always this confusion as to whether, the weak values, for instance, might be interpreted as something that is like a mechanical effect or not, or maybe it's a Bayesian, result of applying Bayesian theorem. But the point that I want to try to make is that both things are there, okay? There is there is an updating of information, and there is also what I believe is a mechanical effect. And essentially, the two things are contained in these two pieces of the amplitude. If you look at the modulus of the amplitude, okay, we'll see that it has a very natural interpretation as the likelihood factor for the probability distribution of this reaction variable, okay, when we need to update it given the new information of the post-selection, whereas the phase can be interpreted as, if we interpret it as an operator, you know, like valued in the operator X, for instance, it's a unitary operator that affects a mechanical effect on the apparatus. And as you will see, it's related to the weak value. Okay, so first of all, let's look at the modulus. So with the modulus, we just think, okay, we just take the modulus of this new conditional state, and we express it in terms of the modulus squared of the amplitude and the modulus squared of the wave function. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to look at the probability distribution for this reaction variable X. Okay, and so what we find is that probability distribution falls exactly under, you know, it follows Bayes' rule. It's essentially, we have the prior distribution for the reaction variable given the initial state. Okay, we update that distribution given the new information of the fact that we had that post-selection, and X is relevant in determining the probability of that post-selection, right? I mean, we rotate, I mean, we can think of the unitary operator that's acting on the state, on the state of the system, as taking that state and rotating it as a function of X. And so, of course, that's going to change the probabilities of the final outcome given the value of X. So it actually follows exactly, you know, Bayes' theorem. And the essential idea of Bayes' theorem is you start with some prior distribution for your variable, for your reaction variable. Then you multiply it by this factor that we call the likelihood factor, which is the probability of this final state given X. And then we get what we call the posterior probability in X. Okay. So that's going to be one of the elements that we'll need. And then we look at the phase. And so if we look at the phase, okay, and we take the derivative of the phase with respect to X, to this reaction variable, what we find, I mean, this is a very simple calculation, it turns out that this is exactly a weak value, okay? What weak value? It's the weak value, not necessarily of the initial state, but of the initial state rotated by this unitary operator that's dependent on X. Okay, so you can think of X as some sort of a rotation angle that's acting on this initial state, okay? And I'm using, and throughout this talk, I'll be using the term weak value to refer to the real part of the object, okay? And hopefully you'll see why I concentrate on the real part, and we can discuss the imaginative part if we want later. Okay, and so I'll call this function alpha of X. So it's an X-valued weak function, weak value. And the idea, okay, that's represented in this picture is basically you take the initial state, but then depending on the value of X, you rotate the initial state by you know, that angle that depends on X. Okay, so of course, if you're rotating that initial state, the weak value is going to change. That's this alpha X. So we have a range of weak values that we're going to be exploring, let's say, depending on the value of X. Okay? So the nice thing is, so we now look at the effect of this unitary operator on the conjugate variable P, on the pointer variable, and we see, okay, we just use, you know, like Heisenberg picture, we see what sort of evolution does that the unitary operator determined by the phase implement on P, and we see it's just a shift in P by this X-dependent weak value, okay? So this is pretty much the picture that we want to build. I mean, this is something that we published with Akir about 10 years ago, and the idea, and so we call it the quantum averages of weak values. And so the idea is basically this. Given the new information from the post-selection, we have a posterior distribution in this reaction variable X, okay? So this is gonna be represented by this distribution over here. Okay, so this is telling us basically the weight with which we're sampling different values of X, but of course this translates into different, let's say, initial states that we're rotating. By the way, I mean, the use of initial state is just conventional. We can make this a little bit more precise when we have a, you know, let's say a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and I'll refer to that in a minute. But for the moment, this is a good picture. Okay, so we're sort of sampling different initial states with a fixed final state. But of course, as we're doing that, we're also going to be sampling different weak values. Okay, so they depend on X. We have this function alpha of X. Okay, so we're going to be sampling them with, you know, certain weights that are given by this distribution. Okay, so these are like the sampled weak values, and somehow that's going to translate into an effect on the pointer distribution, on the variable that's conjugate to X. Okay, more precisely, we can do the following thing. So I like to think of a state. So let's see. We have like these two effects that are confounded. Okay, we have. I mean, we start with an initial state. Okay. And so that initial state, you know, describes our state of the knowledge of the apparatus before the measurement takes place, okay? Now, after the measurement takes place, there's two things that happen. I mean, we may start with a situation where we don't have information about the post-selection, or we have information after the post-selection, okay? So the post-selection brings in additional information, okay? And, you know, in principle, we could think also that it's bringing in additional information about the state of the system before, about the state of the apparatus before the interaction takes place, okay? So I want to think of something that I call the conditional initial state, which is basically the initial state of the apparatus, but now what I do is I multiply by this sort of modulus operator of the amplitude, okay, that if we recall in the representation that is diagonal in this reaction variable, what it does is it reshapes the probabilities given the likelihood factor, okay? And so what is nice about this is that then we can write the pointer distribution as a sort basically an average of the point of a quantum average of the pointer shifts given this conditional initial state. So this is an object that would be very easy to interpret classically, right? Because P and X, of course, would be commuting variables here. They're not commuting variables. So I mean, this is an exact result, but it's not necessarily very transparent because of the fact that P and X don't commute. Nevertheless, what is true is the following thing. The pointer shift, regardless of whether we're talking about a weak measurement, a strong measurement, whatever, okay, in this context, the average pointer shift can always, always be interpreted as the posterior probability of this X-valued weak value with this conditional state, which is basically the posterior average, the posterior mean, okay, given this posterior distribution of X, okay? And actually, it also works with the variance. I didn't write it here, but it also works with the variance. So the additional variance that the pointer acquires, okay, has one term that is related to the posterior variance of alpha. There's another term that I didn't care to write it here, but there's also a change in the state from here to here. So that's also going to affect a change in the variance. Okay. So given this picture, we can understand, you know, what weak measurements are within the standard definition of what a weak measurement we've always discussed. And it's basically we have an initial state of the measuring device that, if we look at it in these reaction variable, is very concentrated in X. It's very sharp in X. So sharp in X, in fact, that it's very robust against the effects of this likelihood factor, which is represented by this green curve modulus K of X. So the posterior initial state, if you want, if we look at it in the extra presentation, it's just going to give you a wave function that's just slightly modified. Okay, so it's still going to be very sharp. And then we can go up and see what weak values we're sampling, and we're sampling, you know, a very narrow range of weak values there. So we should expect an effect that is essentially just a shift of the initial wave function of the pointer, okay, by the weak value that is sampled predominantly because of the concentration of this distribution, okay? And this is up to a phase. There's a phase there that's involved, okay? But more generally, we can now think of weak measurements, you know, like in a more general setting, because one of the things we can do is we can say, well, suppose we have, for instance, this likelihood function changing very fast as a function of x, and that usually happens near the areas where the weak values are tend to be strange, okay? And so what's kind of, you know, the effect that that's going to produce is that it's going to take the initial, I mean, the posterior, let's say, distribution of the reaction variable. It might be, for instance, shifted to another point, but it might still be concentrated around some, you know, some sharp value, okay? So when we go up, we're still going to be doing something which is essentially a weak measurement, but maybe not the weak measurement of, you know, measuring the weak value here, but somewhere around here because of this effect of reevaluating probabilities, okay? And this takes care of a lot of the, you know, like these perturbative expansions that sometimes we do with weak measurements if we try to calculate them to different orders and everything. Well, that's essentially what we're sort of doing, okay? It's just that it's not obvious when you do it perturbatively, okay? So that's the idea. But then we can just sort of, you know, move away from this context of measurements and think of this in a more general setting and say, suppose I have, you know, some Hamiltonian that depends on a parameter that I'll call x. But now x, what x is representing is, let's say, a variable that that we use it as a classical parameter in the evolution, okay? I mean, there's a lot of people who work here in quantum optics. So you have mirrors, for instance, you have beam splitters, all these things. And, you know, you have the position of the mirror, the angles of the mirror, and all these quantities that we treat as classical variables in the quantum evolution, okay? Well, I mean, they're subject to quantum mechanics as well, okay? They're quantum systems, I mean, many-body quantum systems, okay? But they have one property that makes them special in this treatment, and is that these quantities are very sharp quantum mechanical variables, okay? So this x, for instance, this parameter is going to be very sharp, okay? And so we just look at the evolution. Again, we sandwich the evolution between the initial and final states. We look at the amplitude. And if we look at the back reaction then on the variable that is conjugate to this classical parameter, okay, well, it's going to be given by the derivative of the phase with respect to x. And if you do the calculation, what you find is it's essentially, okay, there is an I here that shouldn't be here. Okay, these I's are not to be seen. Okay, sorry. But essentially, so it's just basically a time integral of a weak value, okay? And what is the weak value? Well, the weak value is going to be given between two states, which are basically the initial state evolved up to the measurement, but taking into account the fact that the evolution is dependent on that parameter, and then the final state evolved back to the measurement again, okay? Or actually to this time t prime, and then you just integrate over all t time. So you can always understand the reaction in terms of weak values, okay? And, you know, just to give you an example, so, I mean, knowing that, you know, sometimes might be useful because, I mean, some calculations can come up you can do them very efficiently if you just think of, okay, calculate the amplitude and look at the derivative of the phase. So, for instance, you know, let me look at an example like this. So you have something like a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. This is the detector that is that has like an unlikely detection rate, let's say, and let's think of T and R as the transmission and reflection coefficients of this beam splitter over here. This one I leave it at 50-50, okay? But I'm thinking, you know, in the back of my mind, that T and R are more or less close to each other, so we get things that are that might be interested. And so what we want to do is we want to say, well, what's the effect on all these optical elements, on the beam splitters, on the mirrors, et cetera, given the fact that the photon ended up in D1, okay? And so what do we do? Well, we first of all, what we need to do then is to do something that is basically analogous to what we would do in classical mechanics. Think of virtual displacements. Just think of, you know, for each optical element, see, for instance, you know, what would happen if you just change the position of the optical element a little bit. And so that's going to affect a change in the optical path. And so, I mean, if the so here all the mirrors and all the beam splitters are supposed to be at 45 degrees. And I mean, this is a very simplified setting. But, you know, if the beam hits like this from the y direction and bounces off here, this would be the change in the optical path. X and Y are the center of mass positions of the mirrors. Or if it's coming from the X direction and hits here, it would be X minus Y. Okay? And then we just say, okay, well, if we think of that optical, virtual displacement, then we're going to get some sort of change in the amplitude from, you know, bouncing off, for instance, that mirror. And then in the interferometer, we can just start adding up, given the two arms, you know, all the virtual displacements that we get, all the changes in the optical length. Okay, and so the amplitude turns out to be something like this. Delta L1 is this change in the optical length from the, let's say, the reference setting. Delta L2 would be this one over here. Okay, and then we, you know, like a sample calculation, just looking at what is the momentum transfer to, let's say, one of those things. We're just calculating the derivative of the phase. Okay, so you can do it. It's a two-step calculation. And then you come up with these quantities over here. And then, you know, so it's just the result of a calculation. And then you just connect it to, I mean, you can find that it actually satisfies, you know, conservation of momentum if you take the initial and final momentum of the photon into account. But, you know, what's interesting, of course, and we were talking about weak values, and in this particular case, we're going to find something very interesting in this arm. It's basically if the transmission is greater than the reflection of this beam splitter, for instance, you get all sorts of weird momentum transfers. These are basically momentum transfers in X and Y in these elements. So when it bounces off this beam splitter, for instance, it actually pulls it in that direction, bounces off this mirror, pulls it off in that direction, et cetera. Okay, of course, I mean, those are extremely small effects that are buried under the noise. I mean, in order to get this an effect like this, we need, of course, that the uncertainty in these optical elements be much smaller than the wavelength. And that means, of course, that the effect in terms of the momentum kicks is much smaller than the spread in the momentum, okay? So here I just want to illustrate, you know, with this example again, this effect of, okay, now thinking of this weak values as a function of these reaction variables. So I'm just concentrating on one mirror, let's say this one over here. So I look at the amplitude as a function of the displacement of the mirror from that sort of reference position. And what we find then is that the, you know, depending on the values of T and R, okay, generally, okay, as a function of X, if we look at this as a function of X over lambda, okay, generally the momentum transfers are within, let's say, the normal range of expectation. But, you know, sometimes if X is sufficiently small, okay, then, you know, we can get things that are outside that range. And we know, of course, this should be a K, sorry. And we know that those effects are usually accompanied by situations of very low probability or very low likelihood. Okay, so what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen is basically that if, you know, if I start with an initial state of the measuring device with a pointer distribution that is very sharp, this likelihood is not going to change very much. And so at that point, we're actually measuring some sort of eccentric weak value over here, and we see that shift very clearly. As we start making the uncertainty in x a little bit larger, okay, then the likelihood factor starts having an effect, and then we're sort of sampling. Let's say, for instance, as we make it larger over here, here we'd be sampling, let's say, two weak values, which are, you know, rather normal. And, you know, Fourier transforming this distribution with the shifts that you get from here, then you get some sort of, you know, like the standard strong measurement result, okay? And this sort of motivates the way in which we understand strong measurements. Basically, we're going to have this weak value curve over here. We have the state of the apparatus in the X representation, that's now going to be very wide. And so what's going to happen is usually I didn't draw it here, but this likelihood factor is going to completely change the shape of that wave function. Okay, so now it's a totally different mess. And you know, it seemed that it's very hard to understand in terms of weak values. But still you can do it. Why? Okay, because what you can do is you can take this wave function of the apparatus, okay, and chop it up into little functions of compact support. And so each one of those functions is actually sampling very sharply, you know, a given weak value. So finally, if you sort of resynthesize the wave function, okay, you basically understand it as a, let's say, like a quantum superposition of weak measurements. Each one of these window functions is just measuring a weak value, and then you just superpose them up, and that gives you the wave function of the pointer. And this is what I've tried to illustrate here. So we have, this is, let's say, the reaction variable distribution. This would be the amplitude that I'm choosing. It's a very simple amplitude. It doesn't have a likelihood factor there. But the weak value curve is basically a cosine curve, which you can follow over here, okay? And so each one of those window functions is sampling a weak value. When you add up everything up, okay, you get this probability or amplitude for P, square it, and you get the distribution, and then the distribution has this characteristic shape of, you know, the strong measurement. In other words, peaks at things that we would think of eigenvalues. Okay, what I want to do finally is just to give you an example of how we can understand a transition from a weak measurement to a strong measurement given this language. Okay, and so I've chosen the following situation. So this is some sort of a coherent angular momentum state. This would be your initial state. It would be your final state. And let's say that we're measuring the weak value of the angular momentum along this line. Now, there's a geometric construction for that weak value, which is basically just take, you have this line here, which is constructed by the two tangent planes to these points. Okay, so as you make this reaction variable rotate, of course, this sort of weak value is going to rotate as well. Okay, and then if you look at the projection of that weak value onto the z-axis, for instance, then you're going to get a curve like this as a function of this q. Now, this is also accompanied by regions, which are the dotted regions here, so a very low likelihood, okay? So now what we want to do is we want to look at a situation where you start with a very sharp initial state in this reaction variable and slowly, you know, move up, increase the uncertainty. And so what we're going to find is if it's very sharp, it's going to be very concentrated, and it's sampling a weak value around here, and this is the effect that you see. It's a very large shift in the pointer variable. As you start making the uncertainty bigger, what happens is this likelihood factor becomes significant, and so it might develop, for instance, two lobes. Okay, and here it's very concentrated. The two lobes here are just at minus pi and pi, so there's a 2 pi difference between these two angles here. Now, if you Fourier transform that, okay, you're going to get something. Of course, you're going to get an interference pattern, but what's beautiful about this is this. If you look at, okay, here you have a non-zero weak value that you're sampling, so that non-zero weak value is actually giving you the centroid of this distribution, okay? And the peaks, well, the peaks are the things that we would interpret as eigenvalues of the measured angular momentum, okay? So we can think now of a, of the peaks in the strong measurement as an interference pattern that you get from two weak measurements, okay? And this is just a result that I had where you can also connect weak values to the amplitude, to the modulus, when you look at unitary operators on, you know, an n-dimensional Hilbert space. I won't talk about that. And okay, so I just want to finish. So what I want to say is weak values underlie the statistics of arbitrary strength quantum measurements, not only weak measurements. The back action in a system represented classically in a quantum evolution is a weak value, okay? And you can also look at the papers. You can also see that probability amplitudes in quantum mechanics can be expressed as functions of weak values.
Thank you very much. It's a very inspiring talk.
Thank you.
But I will give talk essentially about the same subject, which will sound completely orthogonal.
Oh.
But I'm not sure that the consequences are different. Maybe it's just a little.
Okay. Well, it's good to have different
questions.
It's like you mentioned about the just a real part of the weak body.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Then it's like how to that.
Okay,
that's the imaginary part.
Okay, so let's go to the imaginary part because this is So the idea is this. Usually, okay, if you have a packet in the X representation that is fully supported, something like a Gaussian, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very sharp, fully supported. Okay, and then you look at the, let's say, the posterior distribution in X, it's going to be shifted a little bit, okay? And it's shifted in the direction in which the likelihood increases, right? Because, I mean, it's sort of pulling it to what is more likely, okay? Okay, and so that shift, you can connect it to the imaginary part. But that is just, it only happens if the packet... Oh, I think that's my computer, maybe.
Yeah.
So it only happens if the packet is fully supported, like a Gaussian or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, but you can think of many wave functions in X that are, for instance, of complex support.
Yeah.
Okay, where if you look at how the centroid moves, it's not going to be given by the imaginary part of the weak value.
Right.
So the imaginary part of the weak value, in a sense, I mean, it describes. In certain circumstances, very well, the way in which, you know, because of which you update your probabilities if the packets have, you know, enough room to move, but it's not a general effect. Whereas what I want to emphasize is that the real part is connected with a unitary operation. So this is a completely reversible effect. It's something that you can really connect with something that's mechanical. Okay.
Does it mean that if you have any composite system and you delegate the role of the apparatus to system B and you have system A, and does your claim mean that the back action of system B on system A is always in terms of weak values?
Yes and no. It depends on time scales, okay? Because I haven't taken into account, like the time evolution of the other system as well. So, I mean, if you think about it, you could, if you look at it, for instance, let's say like in a Feynman integral representation, I mean, you can see more or less how that would be going, and you would say, okay, well, I replace this x by a function x of t. Okay, and so in some sense, okay, that is true. So I'm not going as far as
like
there.
You can look at the image of implicit measurement. Implicit measurement, and then it will be true.
Yeah, yes, that's true.
You can then, implicit measurement can either be weak or strong, depending on what is happening, but for implicit measurement, then this statement is correct.
Yeah.
Does it mean collisional interactions?
Yeah. I mean, sure, it has a very sharp function of time, and any A times U, and then this segment will be correct.
I think so, yeah.
this is your pointer version.
Yeah.
So don't, is it what I believe, if it's weak enough, you just put here a weak value.
Yeah, that's it. That's a weak value. That's a weak value, yeah. But
no, so you don't have to have complex, not complex, imaginary, not imaginary.
Sure.
This is general for anyone. You don't have to distinguish between complex or not complex. This will be the story. Just put here a this weak value. You'll have to renormalize it when you put it
sure,
here.
Sure, sure, sure.
But up to this,
sure,
it's
sure,
just
sure.
This will be correct generally.
Yes.
No, any kind of special treatment, imaginary, complex, whatever.
Yes, I agree. Because, of course, I mean, if you have a packet of complex support in X, okay, it's going to be analytic in P, and then, of course, you can shift it in P, at least within a strip, okay, in the complex plane. Okay, so it is...
Same as long as it's changing in the plane, then it's the right segment. But it's only when it takes actually weak.
I mean, the thing that is...
When it's an extremely short time.
Yeah.
Every
okay.
interaction for a very short time will automatically will be weak enough. So for post selection is just for short time, this is completely general.
Yeah, for... Okay, if it's sufficiently concentrated, yes, you're right. Okay. But...
Okay. Yeah, I think we should stop here.